Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 11th annual Gila River Festival. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continued support. I see a lot of our supporters out here in the audience tonight, so thank you. For those of you who don't know, I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, which is one of three partners that comprise the Gila Conservation Coalition. The other partners are Gila Resources Information Project, or GRIP, and the Center for Biological Diversity. Our festival theme this year is Finding Balance in a Changing World. As the powers that be continue to move forward with plans to divert the Gila River, we, the people, have already figured out some ways in which we can meet our water needs, live within our water budget, and keep the Gila River free flowing. We're waiting for our leaders to give up their outdated water fantasies. We're waiting for them to join us in the real world, the one in which nature bats last. I'd like to introduce now Western New Mexico New Media Professor Peter Bill, the mastermind behind this year's Gila Time Lapse Film Festival. Peter has put in countless hours to pull this together, and this is in addition to working his day job. It was Peter's inspired idea to invite Godfrey Reggio as our keynote speaker. Please welcome Peter Bill.
You know, in my mind, Kyanis-Katsi is one of the truly the great works of art of the 20th century, and I think we're so honored to have Godfrey come down from Santa Fe to come talk to us. And without further ado, here's Mr. Reggio himself.
I do want to say this before I start, that I always work with people more talented than myself, and whenever I comes up, it really means we, because this is a collaborative form like life itself. We're not independent beings. We live, we get our knowledge through the relationships that we have. But please know that's the work of many, many people. So, this evening, I have more to say than I can speak. So I think that they've chosen, in a way, the wrong keynote speaker. I'd like to recommend what I think would be the perfect keynote speaker. And I do so with great humility. The great keynote speaker, let's back up a minute. Do you know what a keynote is? A keynote is the foundation, the tonic. If you look at it in music, it's that which produces out of all of these different capacities a unity of form. So it's very important. It's a foundation. So it's beyond my scope to offer you that this evening. And that who can offer you this, you know better than I. And the keynote speaker for me is the Gila. It is the wilderness, it is the rivers that are here, it is this beautiful place that has been taken care of by indigenous people for centuries. We're like only visitors at this place. And let me say why I think the Gila is our keynote. I'm a filmmaker, and I realized early on that all location or land has a voice. Let me look at it another way. I don't like the terms, but I'll use them. Every landscape has its inscape. And the inscape is the voice of that location. And it can be heard. You've heard of the term genius loci. This is what a place has to offer. It has a voice. If you know something about shamans, many shamans learn the voices of birds. Why? Because the bird knows the environment better than the human animal. It has a bigger range. So what I'm trying to say is that try to listen to this voice of Gila, because this is your keynote, and it's in a point where it needs to be heard. My role tonight will be simply a commentator. And a commentator, as you well know, you'll probably find out more about me than the subject, like most commentators. So I can only offer you, by conjuring up words, to offer you a mental picture of something that I feel literally is untellable. And that's the situation we're in today in this world. And I would look at it in the following way. I'd use these comparisons. Are we going to look at the fire, or are we going to look at the smoke? And for me, it's most important that we look at the fire, because we've been blinded by the smoke of our affluence. And it is the fire of our affluence, the way of life that you and I live, that I'll get to in some gritty detail in a minute, that has created this insanity that we live with that is indeed untellable. I would look at it this way. You know that Americans consider themselves exceptional. Well, we're not the only people. Napoleon, Attila, Hitler, the Greeks, the Romans. By exceptional, we mean you are capable of breaking any rule you wish because you are the exception. Now, we can see that, but let's look at it in a much larger scale. As human beings, as human animals, we consider ourselves the exception, and we do that if we look at not the platitudes that we speak about saving the planet or making world peace. That's something easy to do. We do that through the way of life that we live. We have become exceptional as animals, and the rest of the animal kingdom and the place that all of us call home are suffering because of this exceptionality. So please be clear, and that leads me to the title of what I wish to speak to tonight, from that famous song, Take a Walk on the Wild Side. Now, the wild side, let's look at its opposite. The opposite is just what I talked about, this exceptionalism, that we're special somehow, that we have a special place here, that we're here to take care of everything else, and of course, we're soiling the nest. To talk about the wild side is to not talk about civilization. It's to not talk about our exceptional faux character. So to introduce it, I want to give you a fable from animal mythology, because the animals are our cousins, as we are a human animal. Lauren Isley says, I'm sure you know the quote, we have not seen ourselves as human beings until we've been seen through the eyes of another animal. And I'm not talking about your kitty cat. That's domesticated. That animal loves you because you feed it. I'm talking about an encounter. Or René Dubois, his beautiful book, So Human an Animal. We are ourselves animals. And we should keep that in perspective. It gives us the humility of where we are. So in animal mythology, there is a story about the lion's roar. And what does the lion do? The female lion roars her cubs into life, provokes them into the place they live. Now hold on to that a minute. In Greek, the word for beauty is kalos. However, it shares a root with another Greek word, kalio, which means to provoke. The beauty that you're surrounded with is unimaginable, and it's something that we almost can't see, because all of us today, no exceptions, are on speed in rush hour, outrunning our future. In my opinion, to get heavy, we all live in a state of shock that we call ordinary daily living. When we live this way, like anyone that has the appearance of health, we can be subject to sudden collapse. And I want to suggest three among many. Two in particular, an ontological earthquake. Now, what do I mean by those big words? The meaning of life, the ground of life, has changed itself. It is itself changed. To me, this is a tremendous earthquake. We don't live on the earth, we live above it. We don't live with the earth, we use it as resource to support our own world. So sudden collapse could happen also through digital tidal waves. All of us live in a world where technology is the main event, and we are being hit by that tidal wave, all of which is causing this climate catastrophe that we're not waiting to have happen, but in my opinion, has already happened. And we now live in this state of shock, worth repeating again, called ordinary daily living. And especially if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, hyper-industrial technological grids called societies, we live in Wonderland. We are consuming the rest of the planet for our own happiness. Now, Elias Canetti said, Elias Canetti is a Nobel laureate, wrote this great book on the crowd. Elias Canetti said, all of a sudden, without realizing it, all human beings exited reality. Now that's pretty intense, okay? The words don't carry the intensity of what I'm trying to say. Homer said it another way. Homer said, which age is this, the sunset or the dawn? This goes back to the lion and her roar. She's trying to provoke us with her beauty, trying to provoke us to see the world in which we live in. And if Canetti is right, we've exited this world of reality. 500 years ago, off the coast of Florida, there was an indigenous community that the Spaniards made their first sighting of, their very first sighting. We know this story through the notes kept by some of the people on the crew. There was such excitement at this event that they got on their best armor, got all pumped up. They went into a community of arguably 500 people, that's what was indicated. And remarkably, there were like 30 people off the boat. They went into the community, they were all prepared. They walked through the community and no one noticed them. They were completely invisible. Now that's not a unique story. In the islands, in the Pacific, when the Dutch went, they had the same experience. And I might suggest to you that we, like the indigenous peoples of 500 years ago, are not seeing the world in which we live. They paid that price. They paid that price, and it was terrible. It's a genocide. We are paying the price of beyond genocide, geocide, where the whole envelope of life, if it doesn't sound too extreme, is itself in question. My words can't be extreme enough to tell you what at least I'm feeling. Now that's either the result of mental illness or being, you know, hopefully attuned to what's going on. So I'm leading to the point that not only the blind cannot see, you and I, from my opinion, myself obviously included, are blind to the world we live in. We are sun gazers. We live in a world where technology has replaced the very sun that we have. This sun never sets, and we are gazing into the eye of this sun. Now, you know what happens to sun gazers? They become blind. And I'm suggesting that we have become blind to the world in which we live. Have become blind to the world in which we live. Let me look at it another way. We see our world through the language that we speak. This is who we are. Wittgenstein says, the limit of my language is the limit of my world. So if we see the world through language, let's look at that. In 1900, we had arguably over 40,000 languages and principal dialects. We had 1.7 billion people on the planet in 1900. Today, we have 8 billion people or thereabouts, and we're approaching in the neighborhood, no one really knows, but between 4 and 3,500 principal languages and dialects left on the planet. There's an inverse relationship. The more population we have, the less language we speak, because the unity that we seek is not held together through diversification. It's held together through homogenization. So our language, from my point of view, is antique. It's no longer describing the world in which we live. Now that's a mouthful, okay? Let me say it again. My language, your language, is not describing our world any longer. And yet if we see the world through language, then we are indeed blind to the very place that we call home. So I'd like to cover with you, given that introduction, I'd like to cover a new terra firma, or we might call it an infirma, technology with a big T, another point of view, destiny, and then the call to the heroic. Those are the four topics I'd try to like to put. If anyone can't stand it and has to stand up and confront me, please do so, or ask a question. Please, I don't want to stand here and just saliva these three ladies in the front row. Okay, so let's look at this. I call it the new terra firma. Being part of nature, if nature radically changes, then we being part of nature, we radically change. Let me give you a little comparison, and I'm putting it under the title of the unity imperative. Whenever there is number, there requires unity for the imperative of action. Okay? I'm going to try to give you the unity imperative of old nature and the unity imperative of new nature. And I'll let you fill in the dots. Old nature is breathing. New nature is breathless. Old nature has an horizon. New nature is horizonless. Old nature has a sunset. New nature's sun never sets. Old nature lives by diversity. New nature through homogenization. Old nature is organic. New nature is synthetic. Old nature is real. New nature is virtual. Word, image, language, number. Immediate, mediated. Mystery, certainty. Embodied, disembodied. Stories, storage. Local, global. Remembrance, data. One group is on planet and the other group is off planet. One is the old terra firma and the new is the new terra infirma, which is our home today. So that's a mouthful. Try to grab that. And what this gets to is the motor for me driving all of this. Technology, probably from my point of view, the most misunderstood subject of the world today. This subject is more important, what I'm going to try to say, than anything of the last 5,000 years. Not because I say it, but because of its impact, because of its visceral presence on the planet. So I'm not talking about technology on all the gizmos that we're addicted to only. I'm talking about technology out of the machine. I'm talking about a technology that is in contradiction to the academic point of view of technology, that it is neutral. It's the use or misuse we make of it. We can help people with medicine, with education technology, but we can blow the planet up with it. I'm saying that that is a false dichotomy, okay? It's not the effect of technology on the environment on economics, on war, on religion, on society, etc., et alia. It's now from this point of view that everything now is situated in technique. When everything is situated in something, that becomes the new and comprehensive host of life. And to me, unlike the beauty of nature, the old terra firma, which we could know through those people that came before the so-called civilized arrive, we know that we can live in harmony with that world. However, with technology, we don't use technology, we live technology. It is as ubiquitous as the air we breathe. It is the new and comprehensive environment of life itself. It's not, and we are so close to it that it's taken for granted. That's why I said ordinary daily living. Ordinary daily living seems so boring and beautiful, whatever you want to call it, whatever it is for you. But it's that I am talking about. So we don't use it, we live it. Also, technology is autonomous. It has a life of its own. It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mary Shelley, at the age of 17, in her brilliance, like Rimbaud, as a young poet, had insights that with age we wouldn't dare to have. So it is an autonomous being. It's not the Frankenstein of Hollywood. It's the Frankenstein that we've given a life to. We're on for the ride. Like, I go to Europe. I didn't fly to Europe. I know that sounds ridiculous. I was strapped in a machine, and the machine took me there. Also, technology has an infinite appetite. It knows no limit. However, we live in a finite world. Now, the little we know from evolution, any entity that lives beyond its limit is going to go into extinction. And I would have to say that I feel that we're right on that cusp right now, because we're, with our infinite appetite, we are eating up this planet. I was a monk for 14 years, so you'll have to excuse me getting biblical on you, but the Pope was in the news today, so let me try. As a Catholic monk, the highest form of magic, if I can use that term, is something called sacramental. And a sacrament, let me give you an example. If you're married, or let's say you're married, you wear a ring, and that ring is a sign of your devotion or your union with your spouse. However, if that ring produced that unity, then you might want to get three of them or take it off your finger right away, because that's ooga mooga. When a sign produces what it signifies, then it's sacramental. And I am saying, anything that we could have said about the divines in the past, we can now say about technology. It is remaking the world in its image and likeness. It has its own language, 0-1. It uses mathematics. I was coming up through the Black Hills today, and there is no straight line in nature, no right angles. And when I go through the road that they had to blast out here, you see these straight lines going right down the rock from blasts. Okay, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that technology produces what it signifies. And this is the key. Its truth, like the divine, becomes the truth. Its truth becomes a necessity without which we cannot live. And as I said before, it is the new sun that we worship. Put that in the context of the new divine, this computer, Ernst Jünger said in Germany in the 1950s that technology is the metaphysics of the 20th century. Technology is a lot more than just the gizmos we play with. It's a whole regime of routine, of organization, of life. It has created an environment that is called, for me, the technological environment. Now, this brings me to kind of the heart of what I'm trying to say. Being sensate, being human beings, we become the environment we live in. It's not by accident that I think everybody sitting here has two eyes, a nose, a mouth, a couple of ears here, arms, legs. Do you think all this just happened? It comes from the environment we live in. If the environment radically changes, then we radically change because we become the environment we live in. Another way of looking at it is the activities that we do every day. Routine. Let me give you an example. The Dalai Lama was in Albuquerque in the 1990s in a big hall there at the university, probably 5,000 people. And after His Holiness gave a talk, he said, I'll be happy to take a few questions. And there was a woman sitting in the front row, jumped up, very anxious. She said, Your Holiness, what is the single most important thing that I must pay attention to? And he said, without blinking an eye, routine, next question. Everybody was shocked. What is this guy talking about? What has he been smoking? Routine? That's what I pay? We become what we do. We become what we taste, smell, touch. We become the senses that we're involved in. We become the daily activity that we go through, the assumptions we make for the sake of our behavior. This is who we are. In that sense, it could be arguable right now, not from science fiction, but now the fiction of science, that all of us are well on our way to a cyborg state. Me? You? Yes, we have in our bodies elements that didn't even exist on planet Earth a mere 120 years ago. We are becoming the world we live in. We have no distance from that world. In other words, what we call ordinary daily living is anything but ordinary. And when you take it in the context, which is almost untellable, of the rest of the planet, all of us 8 billion people, the billion or few that have these resources available to them are taking off all of the heritage of the indigenous peoples from all over the world. They have to cut down the forest to get the pharmaceuticals or the raw materials. Or you go out here a little past Silver City and you see what new pyramids look like, mountains that are shaped into mines. This is something that you could pass by every day. It just seems normal. It's anything but normal. As humans, we have arguably become aliens on the planet that we live on. All this stuff about UFOs and Roswell, and we can get into that. I don't want to go to it, but we are the alien on the planet. If you lived in the Middle Ages, people were seeing angels everywhere. That's true. It's recorded. Oh, I saw an angel the other day flying around at the plaza. Because of our psyches, we see what's happening inside of us. It's like a projection. We are the alien on this planet. We're not being visited by another entity. We're being visited by ourselves who are off planet. And the key symbol of that is that which is in every environmental conference, on church meetings, in the UN, in governments, etc., at Ali ad nauseam, and it's the beautiful blue planet. Blue planet is an illusion. I'm a filmmaker. I always want to know, where is the camera? Where is the camera when you see the blue planet? Off planet. I can take my thumb, if I was there with that camera, and block us out. So the blue planet is the icon for this madness that I'm talking about. More pernicious than the swastika. because it's embraced as that which is going to bring us all together. We are already all together, and we're making a grand mess of it. It's how we can, how our world can become our range of relationships rather than how we can be homogenized into living the same life that everyone else does all the time. So I would suggest that we're addicted to this order. It's not something we have a lot of choice. If you want to eat, if you want to go someplace, like I was driving on the road, as I told you, between 25 and here, I wanted to get out. I was weeping almost. I wanted to get out and walk, but I wouldn't make it. So I really didn't see it, because when you're on speed in rush hour like I was, just going 30 miles an hour, everything goes by in a blur. You think you're seeing things, but you're not, because you're disembodied from the event. You're in this capsule. You don't have the taste, the smell. You can't hear. You can't interact. My world really, and your world really, is your range of relationships, not joining some national organization to save the planet. Save the healer. Help the healer. This is your relationship. To just make yourself feel good and go out and walk around with a placard saying save the planet seems kind of ridiculous to me. What we can be involved in is the place we're in, because this place again has a voice that is loud and screaming for your attention. And this place is the beautiful wilderness, the water of life, and all those species by the uncountable numbers that live here off of this greatness. So technology has become our destiny. And while destiny promises comfort, happiness, affluence, it means power, control, and conformity. It means destiny. And our milieu is making sure of that. Our children are being brought up today to think about me, 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 me. What's going to be good for me? I want my kid to go to college because I want her to be successful. Watch out for that. Success, it's unimportant. What does that mean? Success in an insane world? Money? No. It means that if you follow this destiny, it will control you. The Greeks, however, tell us that no destiny may not be overcome. And you can overcome that through resistance, rebellion, or estrangement. These are very tough things to do because they involve behavior. They involve ordinary daily living. They involve routine. They involve your senses. So the highest degree of freedom that we may have is when we know that which controls us. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe take another look from the wild side on the technology that is the motor that causes the life we live in. I'm a filmmaker, so I know the value of negation. Without a negative, now it doesn't matter because we're in the digital world, but when I started in the analog world, without a negative, you couldn't get a positive generally. There are exceptions, but that's unimportant. So I'm saying there's an enormous positive value to negation. There are many things that we would benefit from not having, of being able to say no to. Don't be, you know, fooled. Don't be saying, oh, that's pessimistic, saying no all the time. The power of no is really the power of yes. If you say no to something, then you can say yes to something else. So I'm suggesting basically that we seek the darkness from the blinding light of technology. That out of darkness, you know. Darkness is a funny thing. As a child, it's like death and darkness are similar. I'm an old guy, so my revolving door is coming soon. And it'll be very dark, okay? And children are what? Afraid of the dark, many of them. Why? Because of the vivid unknown that the darkness has. And you and I, you can be sure, have a date with the vivid unknown. And you and I will be the last to know what that means once we die. Because there won't be any more I. I is something we create in order to give ourselves something beyond who we are. I'm not saying that we don't have an individual nature, but we are common in nature. That's who we are as animals. I'm sure you know our human eyes are very focused. Those are the eyes of predators. The horse and the cow's eye takes in a view way beyond ours. You know that. Horse can see everything. Camel, horse. Humans are like eagles. Boom. That's who we are. So we have to be aware of that. Okay. I would say now that, given what I've tried to say, that there is definitely a call to be heroic today. And I'm not talking about heroic in a Greek mythological sense. I'm talking about heroic in this sense, that those people who are willing to live without necessity. Ivan Illich says that freedom is the ability to say no to technological necessity. And that's where we can find our hero in risk, in defiance, resistance, rebellion. There are two paths that we can take. We can take the path of imitation, or we can take the path of creation. The path of imitation is getting a job, joining the environmental movement, sending in your pledge, being a backer, all those things that are proper to do, but that don't interfere with our comfort, okay? If we can get rid of me and understand that you really find you when you think about the world in which you live and others, that's who we are, then the world is open to a creative possibility. In fact, I learned as a monk that the highest form of prayer is creativity. The lowest form is, Jesus, take my cancer away, make her love me, bring me money, the prayer of petition, okay? Save me, bring me, all those things. The greatest prayer is the prayer of creation. We were put here to create, not to be imitators and followers. We were put here to create all together, all at once, in terms of our world, which is our range of relationships. So, those people that are willing to do that are indeed gonna live in this time. They're going to live many lives, and they're going to die many deaths. This is the beauty of life, that one is to risk themselves. One is to give themselves. Stop thinking about me, me, me. That's everything that comes at you through the media, all the gizmos, the Facebooks, the madness that is associated with that. It's all about making a culture of me, that I become the center of the universe, that I am the exceptional one, and I have to take care of myself. To me, this is hopeless. The hope that I want, the hope that I'm suggesting to you tonight, is the hope in the uncreated future. If we don't have hope in that which we don't know, our language, think about it, our language is predicated on the unknown. Yet we're going into a form of world, of language that is built on perfection, where mystery is gotten rid of for certainty. Technological certainty, and we know that is a ruse. We know that's not real, but it's presented to us in that way. So we have a choice to avoid that, to live in an uncreated future. As exciting and as much suffering as that might cause you, if you feel like you wish to rise to this heroic moment, or you can live in a rooted future. Doesn't take a prophet to tell you what the rooted future is. Let's go to Bob Dylan, it's blowing in the wind. The prophets of the Old Testament weren't talking about the future, you know that. They were talking about the future present. They were saying that it must be, if we do this, but it need not be. The only time we find that syntax in in literature, as far as I'm concerned, is in the book of Genesis, where one is presented with this dilemma that one can know that this is the end, but one also can know that it need not be, and the hero works on the need not be, okay? I often tell, if I'm speaking, because I need money, so thank you very much for the people that brought me. I'm a filmmaker, we make no money. I've given some commencement addresses, and I try to warn the students, don't let their diploma become your death certificate, because it will put you into wage labor, something to be avoided at all costs, even if you have to go on the dole. I'm not talking about if you're a waiter or a bartender or something that's earning a little money to keep it together, but if you're in earnest about making money, that's what I'm talking about. So, let me leave you with a couple of quotes, then I want to open it up more. I feel like I've spoken enough. I've said so many things that I'm sure are challengeable, that hopefully have been like the lion's roar, have been provoking you with something beyond the ordinary. Goethe says, I'm sure you know the quote, but let me quote it. And it's probably Goethe didn't even say it like most quotes, okay? However, it's attributed to Goethe, like many things attributed to Jesus or whoever. Whatever you can do, or think you can do, or believe you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. Now, Zen being much less wordy than Goethe says, leap and the net will appear. So that's what's being offered to you. You have this beautiful keynote right in your midst. The Gila Wilderness, of course, just for New Mexico, is over 3 million acres, much bigger than anything else in the state of in this big state. I heard the hearings a couple of weeks ago of a commission that was investigating the Gila Dam or the Gila Madness, and it became apparent after listening to these people that they knew absolutely nothing that they were talking about. They were selling us the Brooklyn Bridge. Okay, that's how much they knew about it. And what was even more important, some very conservative representatives realized that and said it, that these people don't know what's going on. But you do. And so your opportunity to be heroic is here. Your life is but small. The healer will live forever, and you can help that. So please, thank you, and let's talk a little bit. So.
That was rad. I'll try and run around and give people the mic when they want to have questions.
Godfrey, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between the kind of creativity and freedom you're talking about and resistance?
Resistance can be
to ordinary everyday life what that means.
Well, because I believe we're creatures of habit. I know we are. I mean, in all of you have your own experience to examine. Even the way you wear your shoes. You walk the same every day. Some people can tell a lot about you psychologically by just looking at the back of your shoe. It's called the four temperaments. Anybody? That's before we had modern psychology. Stuff that came out of the Middle Ages or from Aristotle. But to go back to your question, I'd say the first thing is to be clear about how one intends to live their life. And we don't live in a vacuum. We are dependent beings. It's very hard to be alone. Not that being alone is something wrong with you, but it's difficult. We can't, like, you cannot see yourself until someone else looks at you. I don't see myself, okay, thank God. You can see me. So you know more, in a way, about me than I do. We are all actors on the stage of life, and our friends know when we're really hamming it up, okay? So I'm saying community is important. And for me, this is very radical, never to get a job. Now, I'm not talking, again, let me just say this, I'm not putting down people that need a few bucks to pay the rent. I'm talking about a life decision to go after money and career and fame or celebrity or whatever it is you happen to be looking at, that this is the gateway to what I think you're talking about, how one decides how they're going to take their steps in life. And our children, who many of us are afraid of now, who we don't understand at all, and who have been offered nothing but me, 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 many of them are rejecting this. They're going into a more anarchic form of life. Who knows where that will lead? But it's got to be better than going into the market. I know politicians want jobs for everybody, and Los Alamos gives us jobs, and Sandia and the mines, but it's much more than having a job. That's a con job. Okay, we can create our jobs. The one thing that authority fears most is the ability of people to organize themselves. And I'm not talking about demonstrations. I'm talking about organizing. And like if you were talking to a bishop and you wanted to affect that bishop, you would never talk about Jesus Christ, okay? That would be easy for the bishop. You want to talk about property, real estate, because this is the interest of the bishop, okay? So you want to go to where the real, beyond the facade of words, you want to get to the real words. And to me, this is what's possible today. But it's willing to live a life that's going to die many times. And as a filmmaker, my biggest teacher are all the mistakes I made. And that's true for all of us in life. For some people, mistakes never leave them, and they become crippled in life because they made a mistake. Or their mother told them they made a mistake. Or their father used to beat them and tell them how stupid they were. It's not that. Mistakes are the way we learn how to bring things closer to ourselves. Yes, please.
Not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking have both said that's, you know, end game. And even to go further off planet, that they, however you want to say it, realize that's the real deal. The real deal, yeah.
Well, you know, when I started to make films, I had this idea in mind, as if an alien had appeared here, alien quote, and they noticed that the main event were all of these machines running around with lights on them, and these little things servicing them, getting in them, jumping in and out, but it's the machines that ran. I think everything I tried to say tonight is an answer to your question. That we're already at a state of artificial intelligence. I don't know who said it, but it's real. Whatever can be done will be done. Technology is not a human. It has its own determinations. It has its own imperatives. It's not answerable to us. We're Twiddledee and Twiddledum. If Bill Gates disappeared tomorrow, believe me, there's a zillion other people running up to take his place, okay? So it has a life of its own. Now that, it's autonomous. I tried to say that earlier. And in that sense, it already has an artificial intelligence. And it operates through abstraction. When Galileo promoted his great ideas about starting, you know, the separation of the phenomena from the noumena, of if you can't weigh it, touch it, smell it, taste it, it's not real, all the stuff about the scientific method. There were other people around at that time, very bright people, but now discarded by history, who said, but that's an abstraction. It doesn't exist in reality. Wittgenstein knew that. He says, if you look at something, you change it. Okay? Or the limit of my language is the limit of the world I deal with. We're looking at the universe through mathematics, like the path I took here through the Black Mountains, nothing at right angles, everything magnificent, but nothing with that kind of razorness other than the cut in the mountain. That's where we are right now. We are cutting the mountain. The mountain is a metaphor. So to me, it's already here. And we're strapped in for the ride. And that's why I think the catastrophe has already occurred. Now that can sound hopeless. But unless one is willing to be hopeless about something, one cannot become hopeful about something. What I told you about what I tried to suggest about the heroic is that these are people who live with startling hope. Hope is the only virtue that is the only virtue that uses its own word to define it. It's hope is the substance of things to be hoped for. So it's a very mercurial virtue, but it's something that we can't live without. But I'm suggesting that we can be hopeless consciously about certain things. To me, these are hopeless that I talked about. In order to be, in other words, hopelessness is the rooted future, which we're all headed on the path to. We're at that crossroads. I can't resist. Yogi Berra died yesterday. When you get to the crossroads, take it, okay? But you got to know what the crossroad is. This crossroad is a turning point or a vanishing point. And if it doesn't sound too biblical or too extreme, I don't even think my words are capable of summoning the extremity that I feel that this is the time we're in. We're at that point of a turning point, a vanishing point, and the catastrophe is upon us. So to me, this gives us great opportunity for hope, because hope is something you create, not something you wish for. Hope is a substance.